Being Single Today, the 8th talk in a series titled Love, Sex, and Marriage, was presented by Nancy Scott on May 17, 2005, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
We've talked about the fact that that sexuality is an expression of a natural language that communicates commitment, and that it was created for this purpose to ratify the marriage commitment to communicate in this special kind of language. And so given that marriage is then really the only context in which it's appropriate to express our sexuality with another person. We also talked about how outside of marriage, then, the implication is that communicating with the sexual language is the reason that it's not appropriate is because it's basically lying. It's not being truthful because you're saying something with your body that you're not saying with your life and your mouth and your words. So that's the reasoning for it not being appropriate outside of marriage. We talked a bit last time, too, about emotional commitment and emotional fornication, the idea that making an emotional commitment prior to being married is also not an appropriate avenue, that rather being really cautious and careful about what we communicate to a person of the opposite sex is really appropriate so that we're clear with ourselves and with each other about what it is we're going for and what it is we're going after in the context of our friendships. So emotional fornication then would be the case where I'm acting on an emotional commitment that I'm making apart from actually making the commitment to marriage. So we talked a little bit about that. And then we talked about sort of this awkward stage of going from one to the other, that if there's two states, we talked about then there's two states, one is being unmarried and one is being married, but there's not a really clear picture of what the transition looks like. And that's just going to be kind of messy and awkward and different for every couple and different for every individual. So it's not really, there's not really a program for that. It's just going to be what it is. And we need to really work to be responsible and loving and careful with one another along the way toward that. Kind of underpinning all this is the idea that the purpose of marriage is not necessarily for fulfillment or for making all of our dreams come true or making us whole people, kind of the things that our culture tends to tell us that marriage is for, but rather that marriage is a tool that God uses to bring us toward wisdom and into our sanctification. It's a tool among many tools. I would argue that singleness is also a tool that's used in that way by God. So, and that's the tool that we're going to talk about a little bit tonight. Is that a good review? Did you guys have remaining questions or thoughts about last time? That I actually think I might pick up on a couple of themes that came up last time a little bit in this talk. But like last time, although it's not a dialogue with Larry here, I think he is going to be back next week to do that again. When we talk about how to relate to the opposite sex before marriage. It's going to be another week of talking about sort of this whole theme. But meanwhile, my goal for tonight is that we also have plenty of time for discussion and that you feel free to ask questions along the way or clarify anything that might come up along the way. So I'll make some comments, some general comments and some specific comments, and then open it up more broadly for discussion. Okay, so we've talked about how there are two states, married and unmarried, and that what we talked about last time as kind of pseudo-marriage, I don't know if I called it that last time, but kind of this this in-between or this trial sort of thing that we tend to do in our culture is not really appropriate in terms of a way to relate to one another or to express a commitment, because there's not enough commitment to make it a marriage, but there's not really but there's more commitment that is really appropriate apart from marriage. So that's what I'm calling pseudo marriage. It's sort of a way of being a couple apart from being married, and I'm suggesting that that's really not the best way to go. Okay. So there's the state of being unmarried. That's also an option. Singleness and marriage, from my perspective, are both gifts from God. So whether we're single or whether we're married, it's because God has decided this on our behalf and has given us this gift. We may like that gift that he's given us. We may not like the gift that he's given us. But the fact is that whatever state we're in, that's the gift that God has given us. So at this stage of your life, if you're married, that's the gift that you have. And that's the gift that God has given. That's the context God has given for you to be working out your faith and your sanctification. If you are unmarried, then that is the gift that God has given you. And for however long that remains to be the case, that is your gift. And so I think it's helpful to think about it this way, because then it's like it's this thing that we have for a time. I think the same is true for marriage. Marriage, we don't really know how long we'll have that gift. No one really does. Not because of divorce, but because of death. Because God decides the days that we have to live, and God decides in this very profound way what our lives are going to look like. So whatever gift we have from God, we have it for whatever time he gives it to us. And I think we can look at being unmarried the same way, that the time that we have of being unmarried is that gift that we have, and that can change. It can change quickly. It can take a long time before it changes. But either state we find ourselves in, that's the place where we are called to interact with who we are and how to be caring about those that God puts in our path. So, I think that there's sometimes confusion about the gift of singleness, because it seems to be understood from a couple of different places where Paul writes about it as kind of this preferred state. And I don't know that that's actually the case. I don't know that that's an accurate understanding of what Paul is getting at in the passages that are referred to there. But what I do understand is that from Genesis, and kind of from what we've talked about in this course so far, is that the natural state actually is to be married. God has created us, male and female, and he's created us with a set of needs and desires, and he's created us in a way that we fit together with another person of the opposite sex, and that's really the natural way that God intended for us to go through this life. So that said, I think that people who are not married but want to be, I think that makes sense. And so I just want to say that fits, because it's what we're created for. For people who make the decision to not marry, I think it's a valid decision to make. There are a lot of reasons for making that decision. But what I think it should not be based on is sort of an idea that that I don't need that, or I don't really want that. Or I mean, there can be a lot of reasons to decide to not marry. And yet I think that we can hide very easily in an understanding that says there's something spiritual about choosing to be single, and because maybe I can serve God better, I can have the freedom to do ministry, which all of those things could very well be true. But I think we really need to recognize that we're created, that there's going to be a certain hardship in that because of the way that we're created. And that's okay. That's okay to decide to do that, but knowing that needs to go hand in hand with that. It's not going to be a state that, because I've decided on it, it's going to be blissful, or any more than marriage as a state, because I've decided on it, is going to be blissful. Because really the goal of this life, from God's perspective, I don't think God is as concerned about our bliss in this life as we are. I think he is concerned about that in the life to come and in our ultimate fulfillment being found in becoming fully human and thoroughly righteous and moral from the inside out. That will be our true fulfillment in the next life. Okay. So, as we find ourselves single, whether by our choice or not, we are to live responsibly with that gift and consider it that way. If by our choice, not allowing the fact that we chose it as a way to hide from the pain of our loneliness. If not by our choice, then honestly facing loneliness and struggle. There are certain implications of being unmarried. Some are advantages and some are disadvantages. Let's see, you can decide which are advantages and which are disadvantages. I will just sort of list a few that I've observed. Freedom from family responsibility, a genuine freedom to pursue various paths that tend to be restricted by family obligations. There are certain career paths, certain options that lend themselves better to mobility that that families tend to restrict more. Another implication of being unmarried is that there is no expression for genuine sexual needs. So choosing to be celibate, choosing to be unmarried, does not mean you will not feel sexual or want to be sexual or have sexual desires. There are ways to work with those, and I think that whether we're single by choice or by circumstance, that it's really important to work with the fact that we are sexual beings. And if we find ourselves in a state of being unmarried in a way, in this place of not having an appropriate expression for that, then it becomes one of the central challenges of being human, being sexual, and being responsible with desires and needs that really don't have a way of being met or fulfilled. So that's an implication of being unmarried. There's also, I think, in being unmarried, there's limited expression for genuine emotional needs. So where the single person can have very rich and fulfilling friendships, rich and fulfilling family relationships, there is something special about marriage and a family that is not met in not having that. I mean, there's something that's really unique about that connection, about being known in a certain way and knowing another person and going through life together. And the sandpapering of that, the thing that Larry talked about in the first talk about what marriage is, the way that deepens our understanding of ourselves and each other and really intensifies what relationships are really like on the surface in a way that I don't think any other relationship can quite do that the way that marriage can. And so that is really not going to be something that is going to happen the same way for an unmarried person. One of the implications then of being unmarried is that there's a limited expression for genuine emotional needs. While unmarried people can have very rich relationships with friends and family, it's not the same as being married. So if being unmarried is the place that we find ourselves by choice or by circumstance, then this is a limitation that is real, that there's not the same emotional connection or depth that can happen outside of marriage that can happen inside of marriage. So that's a liability. Or actually, I was going to let you decide what's an asset and what's a liability. But that's an implication. Those are some of the implications that I've identified, and I'm sure there are more. And maybe more will come along as I keep talking. The idea of thinking about singleness in this way and kind of looking at the implications and understanding that it can either be by choice or by circumstance that we find ourselves here. Either way, we are faced with having needs that are going to be unfulfilled, not met, because that's going to be the state of being unmarried. We have sexual needs, that don't have a place for being met, and we have emotional needs that aren't going to really be met in the same way without being married. So being single is going to take really facing our needs and really trying to work with being responsible for the needs that we have that won't be met. There are a lot of ways that we can face into our needs, understand our needs, and work with them, and work with how to have as much of our needs met responsibly as possible. But the question is, how do I work with the idea that I might actually have needs that God never intends to meet? So if I find myself being single by circumstance and not because of my own choice, then how do I work with the idea that I have these needs? I think that for a long time in my own single experience, I thought that God, and I think I was taught this in some ways, that God wouldn't give me needs that he didn't intend to meet, that needs were meant to be met, or God wouldn't give them. And so I did kind of a mind game that said I don't really have needs. And so I really cut off a certain part of myself that had genuine needs because of the theology that said, well, I must not have needs because if I had needs, God would meet them somehow. And that, I think that's a real temptation. And I think that teaching is probably still alive and well out there. But I think it's really misleading because I think that that's not necessarily God's first priority for us, is to meet all of our needs. I think God is very much more ruthless about bringing us to wisdom and maturity than to give us everything we need or want. And that actually in the deprivation of our need is often the place where we really come before God in humility and with grace, finally understanding what's really important in this life. That perhaps there is something more important than being fulfilled, than having my needs met. Everything I've just said about being single, I think actually applies to people who are married also. Because keep in mind, since marriage is not the panacea that our culture has led us to believe, its goal is not our fulfillment, but our maturity, the same thing really applies. We're going to have needs that go unmet even if we're married. We're going to have to be responsible with our sexual desires if we're married. We're going to have to be responsible with our emotional needs and to really work with understanding who we are, what we need, how to be responsible in seeking to get those needs met, and then also what to do with the reality that sometimes happens that we don't get those needs met. That's the deal. And I think that's the deal whether you're single or whether you're married. So my encouragement for anyone here tonight, whether single or married, is to think about if you're unmarried and you look forward to one day being married or have that desire, then the best way to prepare for that, I think, even right now, is to really learn how to work with what your needs are and with what your desires are and how to be responsible with that. And I think a really good way to do that is in the context of friendships, like we talked about last time. The idea that working with how we treat other people, how we expose ourselves to other people, how we work with conflict, how we identify what our patterns are in relating, all those kinds of things can happen in the context of friendship. And it's a really good, if you're to never be married, it's starting you on the road that's going to take you toward maturity. If you're to be married one day, then it's starting you on the road that will serve you well in marriage and then on to your maturity. Does that make sense? That work? I think that we live in a rather strange time on a number of levels. As I talked about last week, an era where we have phrases like arm candy, which, by the way, this week I saw printed in a magazine. So it really is a phrase that's being used out there. After Larry reacted last week, I thought, did I hear it right? Maybe I didn't hear it right. But I saw it in print this week. So kind of the idea that we need someone next to us to be attractive, to be the it couple, to kind of be all that, and that sort of, we're kind of bouncing off of each other to create this image, something like that. I think that's what kind of comes along with that. I think we also live in a time when marriage has fallen on very hard times, and it is not a particularly, I think within the church there's still some respect for marriage, but even within the church I think it's not what it used to be, and it's I think we have a lot of fear of marriage. And so I want to spend a minute talking about how we look at marriage and how we've kind of developed this level of fearing marriage. Because I think it plays into the cultural things that we're seeing of people delaying marriage, delaying getting into families, as well as avoiding it altogether. There's a quote I want to read from C.S. Lewis out of The Four Loves that I find interesting. And it goes like this. Since we do in reality need one another, then the failure of this need to appear in consciousness, in other words, the illusory feeling that it is good for us to be alone, is a bad spiritual symptom, just as lack of appetite is a bad medical symptom, because people do really need food. So if someone comes to a doctor and says, I don't have any appetite, they're going to look for something that's going wrong. Lewis is saying that when someone says, I don't need to be married, I don't have that need, he wants to ask the same question, because we're created for it. It's really the natural state, and we aren't meant to be alone. God, in Genesis, it talks about God saying it is not good for the man to be alone, and thus began the creation of marriage. So we live in this kind of epidemic time where marriage is, I think we could talk a lot about where that comes from and kind of how we've gotten here, but beyond that, to just sort of identify what might go into it is perhaps we fear failure because we see marriages fail so often, perhaps more often than not, we see marriage fail. And so we fear that. We fear not having role models for the kind of marriage we might want, and therefore we don't want to risk making the same mistakes that we saw our own role models make. Perhaps we fear being stuck. We fear making a promise that we then have to live with when we don't want to, which I think in actuality is part of marriage, and it's a good part of marriage. It's good to have to keep a promise and to have to work with what that's like when you really would rather not. It's a good exercise and a good spiritual experience. Or I should say it can be. Of course, it can also not be, depending on how you work with it. Oddly enough, this fear of marriage does not always translate into a fear of relationships, because as we've talked about already, pseudo-marriage is actually quite popular. People are couples all over the place. It's, in fact, kind of rare to not be in a couple. But marriage is another story, and so we've separated it. It's like marriage is like, don't do that, but do this. But unfortunately, these kind of serial relationships are often not really about being truly vulnerable, because real vulnerability really should not happen outside of the marriage commitment. Not that it... I think that it can't really happen, because if true vulnerability comes out of being safe with another person, there's not a lot of safety in the promise to be together for at least another month. So when we make a promise to be together for at least another month, or maybe even at least another year, there's a risk inherent. It's like we're going to be looking down at that spot of whenever we get to the spot where, you know what, I've decided we're really not a good match. Whether it's a year down the road, whether it's 5 years down the road, we continue looking at that spot, and it doesn't make any sense to be vulnerable. It doesn't make any sense to be really raw with that other person, or to really expose yourself on the brutally real, honest, deep level that marriage demands and also offers. I mean, it's like this wonderful thing that you get to know someone and be known in that way, because you've promised that, you know what, even 5 years from now, even 10 years from now, we're going to be here. We're going to be working with this. And so you have the safety to bloom in the context of that and to deepen your connection with that other person. I'm aware that I'm talking almost more about marriage than I am about being single. And the topic is being single. So I just wanted to kind of identify this fear of marriage as kind of, I think, a symptom of something that's happening for us today that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think anyone who has the models for marriage that we tend to have in this generation, it makes sense that you might fear marriage. I think that I came up kind of in the midst of the sexual revolution when perhaps the things that we're living with now were kind of just getting going. I had the experience of not believing in marriage myself when I was in college, and we were all kind of on this roller coaster of deciding a new and brave new way to do things, and marriage was the thing of the past. Marriage was not the way to do it. That's how I would say it is, I don't believe in marriage. Marriage doesn't work. It's not what you want to do. And I think over the years, I really began to understand what went into that for me and how it had a lot to do with my own personal fears of really traumatic loss, which had happened to me in my own family at a really early age, because I had this loss that was sort of in my nervous system, in my body. It was like I didn't identify it that way. I didn't really even recognize it that way. But because I experienced this really traumatic loss when I was very small, I kind of had the emotional belief that loving meant losing. And that translated into a lot of really deep fears on my part. But rather than really knowing that, I could grab this banner and say, marriage is passé, marriage is a bad idea. And so that kind of serves as an example of, if I have a really strong feeling about not marrying, I think it's worth exploring that. Kind of like Lewis is saying. It's like, if I'm saying I don't need that, I don't want that, and I'm being really strong about that, it might be a symptom of something else going on that I think could be really helpful to look at. In my case, kind of coming to understand that this really early loss translated into this belief for me didn't make it any easier to decide that marriage was a great idea, but it did help me understand what went into this very real hesitation I had toward that. And it also helped me kind of work with what do I really want? What do I really fear? Maybe it isn't really marriage that I fear. Maybe it's loss that I fear, or you know, any number of other things. So it can be a way in to really understanding ourselves in a different way. So that's one of the ways that we can listen to what we feel. And on that note, I want to just say a word about feelings that relate to a little bit back to last week as well. We talked about having feelings for another person and what to do with that and what happens when we get infatuated. And this is another thing that I think part of being single is that you've probably heard people say that, well, I might be single, but I'm not dead. It isn't that being single takes away all those desires, just like I've been saying, but so it's unrealistic to expect that even if you decide to be single, that you won't ever end up having a crush on someone, or you won't ever reconsider that decision, or you won't ever change your mind. In fact, even decide that was then, this is now. I'm going to do something different. But I think it's really important to understand that our feelings are not something to be put away or squashed, but are something to be listened to. I think we sometimes fear our feelings because we've experienced people, or we've experienced it in ourselves, where we've acted on feelings in a way that's been hurtful to us or to other people. And I think that's an easy thing to do. But rather than decide that feelings shouldn't be listened to and should be put away because of that, rather I would suggest that feelings are this really good, helpful information that help us decide how to behave in a loving way more clearly. So in other words, if I have all these feelings going on and I have a big reaction to something, and I react on you about that, then that's I just get mad or I blow up or whatever that looks like. Well, what I'm not taking into account there is there's this big thing happening inside of me that's really about me. And it feels like it's about you because you just tripped the switch. But the way to be responsible with that is to really work with what is it that just happened inside of me and how do I work with that? Then, after I go through that process, I can come to you and say, gosh, this is what it feels like to be me, knowing this, knowing what I know about myself now. And this is what it was like for me when you did what you did or whatever. And they may or may not have done something intentionally hurtful. They may have done something hurtful without knowing it. They may have not done anything hurtful at all, but it was all, you know, it's very complicated. It's very complex. And so the best we can do is to really try to listen and understand ourselves and know what things we react to and kind of what goes into that for us so that we can take that on and be responsible. So when it comes to romantic feelings, acting on romantic feelings outside the context of a marriage is perhaps inappropriate, but feeling the feelings and processing the information and making a good decision with it, what do I really want? What can I really do with this or not do? What does this tell me about who I am and what my desires are? Those are really good questions to have be raised by those feelings. Whether or not I share those with the person I have a crush on is a whole other story, and that's a lot of what we talked about last time. So this is all going into the idea of choosing to live responsibly with really big feelings, with really big needs, and in the midst of what is sometimes really intense loneliness. Again, whether single or married, loneliness is part of being human. It's not really just part of being single. So marriage is not necessarily going to take your loneliness away. In fact, I would say it's guaranteed to not take your loneliness away. That there are a lot of things marriage brings and a lot of gifts that it gives. And there are still struggles about being an individual and being human and being on a certain level alone. It's really existentially between ourselves and our Creator that we have to work. And so we have to kind of take that on and know that, whether we're single or married. Okay, so that's kind of my remarks. We can open it up for a discussion at this point and see where we go with it.
You talked about when part of making the commitment to marriage is being ready to have a family. How would you address the issue of someone who wants to be married but doesn't want to have kids?
Well, that's a good question. I think it's a complicated question, but I think, again, it really depends on what's driving that. I think it is a really natural thing to want to have children. And it's a really, certainly an organic part of being married. I think that Jack talked in one of the talks about birth control, or Ron maybe, or talked about kind of the goal of not having children is it's really responsible and appropriate to make plans about that, but it kind of comes to light when God changes that plan, sort of what's driving it and then what we do with that. So I think it's not realistic to plan to be married and never have children, quite frankly. I think it might be fine to make that decision and to decide that as a couple, we want the freedom that comes with not having children. And unless God intervenes out of the blue, that's the course that we're on. But I think it is it's important that we understand that God could intervene in that regard. Is that helpful?
Yes.
Sometimes the question of having children is actually a much bigger deal. And I talk with a lot of women who have a fear of having children that's much bigger than perhaps the fear of being married, because I think having children, perhaps they have seen that done in a way that seemed to take away the individuality of the mother. And certainly, there's something about motherhood that does take away every ounce of individuality anyone ever had, because raising children is all-encompassing. And there are certain times and places where you just have to do what you have to do when you have kids. And that can be a real fear that people work with, of how do I stay an individual? And I think it's actually really important and really appropriate and vital that women and men figure out how to be individuals and then be responsible in the different roles that they have. So I don't think it's loving or helpful to really lose oneself in any particular role or identity. I don't know, is that helpful?
My question was about, I think in the first part of your talk, you were talking about sexual temptation, I guess, for the single person. And I was wondering, are you talking just about, like, in regards to, like, masturbation, or is there other, like, sexual desires that you're talking about? Like, are you talking about just about, like, sex, or what exactly were you meaning?
All of the above.
What's the content of the all of the above, I guess is my question. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that the way we're created is sexual, and so we're wired to have sexual desires. I will make a distinction, though, that I don't think that sex is as essential as our culture has led us to believe. And I think that that's a really important thing to know. It hasn't always been like this. It hasn't always been the assumption that you really cannot live without it. Or if you do live without it, you're going to walk funny and look weird and kind of, you know, start doing this because you're not, you know, getting some. So I think that that's a really important thing to keep in mind. But on the other hand, I think we really are sexual beings. And, for example, to be a woman and not be married, I think there comes a place and a time to really reconcile and understand what it means to be sexual without an expression for that. I include autoeroticism in that. I don't think that that's necessarily appropriate that we get to do that. Now, I think it's pretty organic and natural that our bodies do things from time to time, you know, in the context of our sleep or our dreams or whatever. I don't think it's something that we need to beat ourselves up about. But it's those kinds of things that we have to be working with, because when our bodies do that, or when our bodies respond a certain way to a certain kind of stimulation, whether it's visual or touch or whatever, we just really have to work with that. It's like, oh, there it is. There's my longing. And I don't think it's just physical. It might be just physical in the sense that our bodies are doing something kind of apart from our deciding to do that. In that sense, it's purely physical. But on another level, it shows us our sexuality and our desires and our lack, our longing for that, our need for that. Does that make sense? So it's a challenge, I think, to not be married and to be a sexual person and to be responsible with that and to really work with it. And I think it used to be more, our stereotype was that men, of course, have a harder time with that than women. I think that's really changed, and I don't know exactly why. I think probably because sex has become so marketed that now that women now have become very... there are certain gender differences in sexual desire and in sexual expression, and in some ways I think that the marketing of sex in the past 20 years has leveled that playing field and kind of brought women into the... there's kind of a mutual exploitation that's become the norm now, where it used to be more that in some ways men were socialized to think that exploiting women was a way to get their needs met. Now I think women are just as prone to looking at men as... I mean, watch one episode of Sex and the City, you know, it's all you need right there. It's clear that women are in the same place now. So is that helpful?
You may have already answered this question, and I just didn't hear you. I'm not sure. I've definitely heard you talk about instances where you have romantic feelings towards someone and it's not appropriate to go there. Last week you had the example of a friendship you had that you decided not to pursue it. You decided that was wrong for you at that time. And tonight you mentioned that pursuing romantic feelings with another person outside of marriage is inappropriate, or can be inappropriate, at least I heard you say. Mm-hmm. And so far, I haven't heard you present a situation where you do pursue that. My question is, how do you ever become attracted to someone and get to know them with the purpose of getting married if you don't ever respond to those feelings?
Okay.
Arranged marriage.
Actually, that question came up after class last week. Are you advocating arranged marriages? So I think that's a really good question. Well, one of the reasons I haven't used a different example is because it hasn't happened for me, quite honestly. I've only not gone there because I don't think it's been appropriate. But from what I hear, it can happen, and it does happen. And I can imagine a scenario in which it could happen, even for me. But I think that it still is the case that being responsible with those feelings, I'm not saying don't ever pursue them. I'm saying be responsible with them. So I want to make that really clear. In fact, that's one of the things that came up last week about arranged marriages. The reason I'm not advocating arranged marriages is because I think that we have this incredible freedom and this incredible gift in our culture that we get to choose our own mate. And one of the advantages of that is that we might even get to be in love with another person. And being in love is a really cool thing. The thing that you have to watch out for is to understand that being in love, feeling in love, being infatuated, having romantic feelings is an image. It's not the reality. And so, but it's a really good gift. And so, and it really does work to take us toward committing our lives to another person, in which then we get to build the substance that this thing was the dream of. Does that make sense? And in the midst of all the hard work and sweat that takes, there's this incredible bond that emerges that really is the substance of that dream in some way. But it's real, and it's got warts, and it's got good stuff, and it's got hard stuff, and it's got all the stuff that life has in it, where the romantic feelings don't put any of the bad stuff in it. You know, it's like rose-colored glasses all the way, and we're going to live happily ever after. We're never going to have any problems. We're going to see everything the same way. Well, that's just not realistic. It's just not true. But if I have a friendship with someone that I think that wisdom tells me it actually, this could be a really good match. This could make a good marriage. And not only that, but I fall in love with them, and they're in love with me, and we have this thing, and I think that's kind of how it happens. But I think both of those things need to go together. It's wise to do that, and I want to do it. So the wisdom is the decision about when is it time to go there? Are we ready to go there? Do I have enough information? The example I used last week for myself was a situation where I knew this person for maybe a month when I was starting to get really smitten, and that's just not enough time. I just don't know the person long enough, and so that's why I made a decision to pull back how much time I was spending with them, because I was aware that the more time I spent with them, because of my own needs, not because of some magic chemistry that was really happening and that God was doing something there, because it wasn't, but because I have needs and I have longings, and frankly it's been a few years since any of that was expressed, or that the opportunity has even presented itself. And so it's like, I think any of us can have this experience, no matter how long it's been. It's like water in the desert, you know? It's like, oh, that's what I need. That's what I want. And it's like, oh, it's like we're just going to go for it. You know, it's so strong. And that's the part I'm saying, whoa, hold off on that, because we need to know there's substance there before we make a decision. We need to have the information that we can actually make a wise decision with. If we get to have, if we start making a wise decision, here's another piece of this. If we start making a wise decision and we start seeing without the rose-colored glasses and we lose those romantic feelings and start to see reality and go, oh, this doesn't look so good after all. Well, God bless me. Better to know that now than 5 years after you're married. And so I think it's really valuable to risk that happening, in other words. Because really, I don't think you want to be married if it's not the gift that God is giving. I mean, I've worked with people who
just went for it because it was water in the desert and they had to have it, and it really wasn't wise. And they lived to regret it and often to go through divorce, and then could later even say, I wanted what I wanted when I wanted it and I went for it, and there was all kinds of blindness going on in that. And I think when we have that drug coursing through our veins, it's just really easy to do that. So that's what I want to caution you about. It's not that that's a bad thing. It's not. It's a God-given, wonderful gift when it's right, when it's when you're ready, and when they're ready, and when it's actually God giving it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I just wanted to see if you were excluding the possibility there.
Right.
It doesn't sound like you are. So
right.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hey, Nancy. It's Ryan. I'm on the couch.
Hi.
I was just wondering if you could comment on the distinction between sexual and non-sexual touch, and particularly the latter, and both its limitations and its proper fullness in the context of being single.
The limitations of non-sexual touch? Is that what you're saying?
Or more just like, what would be appropriate, what would not be appropriate in terms of touch?
Okay. Well,
I think that it's pretty obvious. It's about certain limitations. So I was more interested in you commenting on the opposite, which would be the proper fullness and place of it.
Okay. Yeah, I think that, of course, the line to where it becomes inappropriate touch is, of course, very individual. But certainly when it communicates sexual feelings, it's time to not be doing that if you're not married. So, and I think that's something that we all kind of know. You know what I mean? We know. Let's face it. Right? You know when it's not right. When it's like, okay, shouldn't go there. So it's not really about, I don't think it's about drawing a line and deciding where the line is so that we can figure out how we can get right up to it and not go over it. It's not really about finding a line so that we can get as much as we can and still think we're doing the right thing. Okay? It's more about understanding what we're communicating. And that can happen way out here. I'm kind of using my hands to talk about this, Ryan, so you might be missing what I'm saying, but oh, that's okay. So that's part of it, but I think it's really more, the question is, what is it I want to communicate with this? And I think with non-sexual touch, that's a really important question too, because what might be from the perspective of someone doing the touching might be non-sexual, might be to the person receiving it very sexual. And so I think that what you're communicating, what you're wanting to communicate, needs to be really clear. So for men and women in particular, and I think this goes for women and women too, I know that there can be a lot of friendship kind of embracing and touching with women and between friends that are male and female. And I think it's, I don't want to say that that's a line, because I don't think it's really about lines. I think it's more about, what am I communicating? And I think that women, between women and women, we should be asking the same question. Like, because what I'm communicating might be completely non-sexual from my perspective, but I don't know what this person's been through. I don't know how they receive touch. I don't know what touch means to them. And so I think whenever I'm going to touch someone, I need to be really clear that that's something that they're inviting, or that that's something that we're clear about what we're doing. And some cultures are more huggy than others, and hugs are great, but some hugging can be really sexual. Some hugging can be really confusing. I don't think there's really a way we can draw a firm line, but I think we just want to be really aware of who we are and who the other person is and what's loving them. It might be loving to touch someone's hand in a moment of connection and tenderness or grief, And it's really appropriate to take a hand and say, I'm so sorry. But it also might be that that's not something that they want or need. And I think we need to be cautious about that. So I think any kind of that sort of thing needs to be, what does it look like to care about this person? Not what does it look like to get what I want? I think that's maybe a really good question to ask to answer your question.
Could you talk a little bit more about just what, like, physical touch, what God has made of that in a healthy way to communicate? I'm aware that there are a lot of studies about like the role of touch and how it can be very healing and therapeutic and actually discourage people thinking too sexually about touch and can help discourage just the hypersexualization that we have today. By learning that actually touch can mean many other things besides something sexual. So could you comment on maybe what's going on in that, those sorts of situations?
Yeah, well, I think that's definitely, it could be not sexual, but I think we need to be really clear about that with, between us, you know, whoever's doing the touching. The studies, a lot of studies have said now that that married people, for example, there's some studies that say that say married people actually live longer than unmarried people, and they relate it to the therapeutic nature of touch. And that people who are caressed and cared for in physical ways are actually have lower blood pressure, are more their hearts are healthier, you know, things like this. There's actual physical connections to that being a better thing. And I can really, I think that makes a lot of sense. We're designed to be married. We're designed to be in couples, and it makes sense that we would work better that way. So that makes sense to me. I do think that there's, because of the over-sexualization of the culture that we're in right now, it's hard to define that, or it's hard to say, you know, it's hard to kind of step back and say, that's not all touch leads to sex. And I mean, because I think that's true. Not all touch does lead to sex. But touch does generally communicate something. And I think, it's just important that we know what we're communicating and that we're working at caring about the other person. And if I think for people who don't have the option of being touched and find that to be a need, I think the emergence of therapeutic massage, for example, could be really healthy. It could be really good, physically healthy thing to do for someone in a way that's a non-sexual kind of touching. And I think also there's a layer of, you know, between unmarried men and women, I think there's a greater tendency for confusion. I think there's a lot of freedom to be physical and huggy with people who our relationship boundaries are really clear. It's like there's not the confusion if we know where we stand because we're both married to someone else, or you're my brother that I grew up with, or you know that you're my parent, or you know someone in my family. That it's just really clear. Sometimes those are not clear either, but they need to be. Get along now. I thought I saw that going on there. I just visited with my brother, and we hugged, and that's a really new thing in our relationship. And we're like, you know, 50-ish. So, Isaiah.
So, you've said that we're created to be married, and I felt like during your initial talk, you talked about marriage more than singleness.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of wondering how...
Being single is the name of the talk.
I guess two questions. One is, how do we deal with singleness? And my other question is, I know some people come to a point where they decide they're meant to be single, and some people are single, but haven't decided that they're meant to be single, which I'm sure a lot of the students in here can probably relate to. Do those two groups of people view their singleness differently?
People
differently?
Could you describe them again? People who have decided to be single or think they want to be single, and then people who don't.
I mean,
but are? Is that what you're saying?
Okay, there's a lot of students in this room,
mm-hmm.
and we're pretty much all single.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that a lot of people here are assuming that someday they'll be married, but they're not there yet.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some people who are single for life.
Mm-hmm.
And some.
What did he say?
So.
And they just don't know it.
Do those. Scarlett, I want to ask my questions. I'm not sure what I'm asking. Okay. Am I making any sense?
I think so, but I'm not sure what the question is yet.
Okay, how...
That some people...
What is the proper way...
A lot of people here are not married. Some will be married one day and some won't.
Yes.
Some want to be married one day and some don't.
So do
that,
we...
Is what you're saying?
Do we approach being single... Are we supposed to approach singleness in a different way?
Okay,
and how...
I got it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On either side, how are we supposed to
right.
deal with being single?
Right. I'm suggesting that you deal with it the same way. Because whether you're single for two more years or whether you're single for the rest of your life, you're single now. And that's the gift. And that's kind of what I was talking about the gift that we have, and that's the gift we need to be working with for as long as we have it. And it can change any time. God can intervene and change it any time. Whether it's being single or being married, God can intervene and change it. Yeah. Is that helpful? But I think the way of being single in either of those situations is the same, and that is to work at being responsible with what our needs are, the ones that are not being met, and the ones that that really don't have a context for being met, in particular outside of marriage. We need to really be responsible with that and work with that. Because the thing is, see, they just are there. It's like whether we know they're there or not, they are. And the more we can know them, the more we can be responsible with them. So it's not realistic to kind of decide, well, like I was saying about my own experience, like, oh, I don't have those needs because God didn't give me those needs, or he would have given me the desire to be married, or, you know, whatever, however we might think about that. We all have these needs. And we all long for connection. We all need connection. And people who are single need connection just as much as people who are married need connection. And so if that connection is not going to come in the form of being married, and I'd say, again, I'm like so mixing it up because it's just not that different, being married and being single. There's some things that are really different about it, and there's other things that are really not that different about it. And that is that knowing what we want and what we need and having to work with it is a human challenge. And also, I just lost my train of thought where I was going with another part of that. That the challenge of being single is, that we have the same needs and that there are ways for some of those to be met. There are some of those needs that are not going to be met outside the context of marriage, because marriage is the context in which to meet some of them. But that said, single people need connection. Single people need relationships. Single people need to find friendships in which they can be vulnerable and in which they can expose themselves and be known and know other people and have kind of this mirror kind of relationship where in a friendship I get to reflect who you are and you get to reflect who I am, even the parts of me that I don't really want to see. Because we all need that, and we all need relationships. And I think that's where Lewis is saying if we experience ourselves as not needing that, there's something going on there.
Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Kristen.
You used the phrase being in love. I was curious as to if you meant the same thing as infatuation or a
mm-hmm.
crush.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Just wanted to clarify
yes.
that.
Yes.
Because you seem to use romantic it in a different mm-hmm. kind of way, like it actually mm-hmm. held weight in determining the direction of a relationship, and I just wanted...
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it does. If it's a wise connection and a wise marriage, it's a wonderful gift to feel in love. And I think it's a fairly important thing. I don't think, that's what I was saying about arranged marriages, I don't think you ought to go without it necessarily. I mean, I don't think there's something noble about marrying someone who fits, you know, who's filled out an application and fits the bill, but you kind of go, well, you know, okay, I guess. I mean, yuck. I don't want to do that.
Could you just switch it up with the word infatuation? So you'd say it would be wonderful to be married and infatuated?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm using it interchangeably. Yeah. And the same thing is true when I feel in love, it's when I have to be careful because it may or may not be wise to act on that feeling. Just like, I mean, it's the same thing, it's infatuation. And again, like last time I was talking, true love, as opposed to what our culture tells us, and what Princess Bride tells us, true love is doing the right thing. Loving someone else is acting in their best interest and doing right by them. And it's an incredible experience to really work with that, especially when everything in me wants what I want. But loving someone else, I mean, that's part of the gift of loving is, and single or married, it's like figuring out how to give in a way that respects and understands another person and their needs and is not selfishly driven out of getting what I need. It's not that I'm never going to get what I need. I ought to be getting what I need too, or there's something going on. But it's a great give and take. So doing the right thing is loving. Okay, that about covers it. Anybody else? Thanks for being here. To be continued, next time is on how to relate to the opposite sex before marriage. Thanks.